Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. On today's show, a documentary filmmaker introduces us to the most famous woman in America we've never heard of. Television pioneer Gertrude Berg, a woman who created, wrote, and starred in the series The Goldbergs, a show about a fictitious Jewish family that lived in a lively tenement in the Bronx. A filmmaker who's dedicated her career to celebrating unsung Jewish heroes tells us why Gertrude Berg is a name we should remember alongside Lucille Ball and Mary Tyler Moore. Plus, we'll hear what you have to say when we share some of the recent mail we've received from listeners and even a phone call or two. But first, the term culture wars was first coined in 1991 by an academic named James Davison Hunter. Hunter concluded that cultural issues like abortion, so-called family values, and gay rights had redefined American politics. And anyone who lived through the election of George W. Bush in 2000 and 2004 would find it hard to argue otherwise. But a new report from the Center for American Progress says that could be changing. This report concludes that the rise of a more progressive younger generation has combined with an increase in minority voters to effectively disarm the culture warriors of the 1990s and early part of this decade. Here to talk more about this phenomenon is the author of the report, Rui Tashara. Rui has written several books on election demographics, and he is a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress. Rui, thanks for being a part of State of Belief.
Delighted to be here.
Now, your prediction of the end of the culture wars intrigues me. The first thing I guess I want to know is this purely a demographic conclusion, or is it more than that?
Well, There are several things that are pushing the culture wars politics down in influence. I mean, clearly one thing is just that other issues have come to the fore that seem much more important. First, Iraq, then the economy. But what I'm arguing in the report is that if you look at the way the country's changing, the way the underlying demographics are shifting, they're changing in such a way that it's going to reduce both the level of conservative culture wars type views, and it's going to reduce the salience or influence of those views. In other words, even when people retain some conservative cultural beliefs, they're going to have less influence how people vote and act and so on. So in that sense, it is a pretty demographic argument, but it covers several things in terms of how that works out politically. Now, the actual demographic changes I'm talking about are first and foremost, the rise of the millennial generation, people born after 1978. And it is very striking how much more liberal or progressive these young adults are in terms of their cultural views than older cohorts. So there's a phenomenon that happens that can cause a lot of belief change in society. It's called generational replacement. So as a new generation comes in that has quite different views and the older and replaces the older generations who are dying off, this really can change the views people have. I mean, a great example of this is gay marriage. Mm-hmm. Gay marriage is supported by, it varies by survey, but it could be by about 20 or 30 percentage points by members of the millennial generation. If you look at the oldest cohorts, it's pretty much the reverse. So by sometime in the next decade, we'll have a majority of adults in favor of legalizing gay marriage. The influence of millennials on progressive cultural beliefs extends to a lot of other things, too, to immigration, to views on race and diversity, to views on gender, and a variety of other things. This generation is just so much more progressive in its cultural views than the previous generations, it's of enormous significance. And not only that, go ahead.
Let me just ask you, how did these people with these ideas grow up in the homes of people who were fighting the culture wars? I mean, they didn't
pick
up. Well,
you might as well ask, how did people who grew up in the 60s turn out different from the parents they raised them?
Mm-hmm.
They grew up in a different environment. People who grew up in the 60s and 50s were growing up in an environment where material scarcity wasn't such a big thing. And they were just much farther from conservative cultural roots than their parents, many of whom, for example, came from relatively culturally conservative countries overseas, or came from the farm, came from rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
Kids who grow up in a different environment that's different from their parents tend to adopt different views. So we have the same phenomenon happening now with these millennials who are raised by boomers, maybe some gen, but mostly boomers. They're coming into a world in which these issues of race, these issues of gender, these issues of homosexuality just strike them as like, why are people fighting about these things? This doesn't make any sense. This has nothing to do with my life. I know gay people. I know black, brown, other people. And, you know, I may have problems in my life, but these aren't my problems. These aren't the things I'm worried about fighting about. They may, in fact, be somewhat traditional, for example, in their views on what kind of family they'd like to have. But on the other hand, the idea that they should look down upon people who have different kinds of families, or that, you know, the one ideal we all should seek is a two-parent household where the mom doesn't work and the father does, and you have Junior and Missy. And so, and all of that seems a little strange to them. So they really do reflect the changing world that they grew up in. And there's, you know, just a, and there's another, a lot of other demographic factors as well that are important to keep in mind, like the decline of the white working class, particularly older white working class voters. Mm-hmm. These are the most culturally conservative element of the population. They're being replaced by basically minorities and also by much more culturally progressive white college graduates.
Is there a rise of voters who are not religiously affiliated, or what's going on there?
That's yet another factor. See, there's a whole slew of these factors. One of the big changes that's taking place in our society is the rise of what you might call religious diversity. So maybe at one point in time, it was you could reasonably think of the typical American as being a white Christian and a fairly religious one at that. That's just so not true anymore. By sometime in the middle of the next decade, we'll no longer be a white Christian nation. And it turns out, if you look at the data closely, the fastest growing religious demographic, if we can put it that way, in the country is not white evangelical Protestants. They're growing somewhat, but not very much. The ones who are really growing are those who are unaffiliated, those you might call secular, those whose connection to organized religion is pretty tenuous. Mm-hmm. And the cultural liberalism of these adults is quite striking. I mean, this is probably the most culturally liberal element of the population, which makes sense when you think about it. But they are the fastest growing. They'll be about 20% of adults by the middle of the decade of the 20s in this century. So they're going up fast.
I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest today is Rui Teixeira, author of the new report, The Coming End of the Culture Wars. There's more to come on this. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, and I'm speaking today with demographer Rui Teixeira about the report he recently authored for the Center for American Progress. The report is titled The Coming End of the Culture Wars. Hurry up, I hear you saying. Rui, I want to talk specifically about the issue of same-gender marriage. I recently sat on a panel about same-gender marriage, right alongside religious conservative Tony Perkins, head of the Family Research Council. And Tony recalled being asked by a reporter whether he felt he was on the wrong side of history. Tony said, no. Look at all the history leading up to this point. He also made a comparison to the debate over abortion, which has continued to rage on. Is Tony Perkins out of touch or really optimistic?
I think he's quite out of touch on the same-sex marriage issue. One of the most amazing shifts in public opinion over the last 40 or 50 years is views of homosexuality in general. Back when I was growing up, nobody talked about homosexuality or gay people, and attitudes toward them were almost uniformly negative. Things have dramatically shifted since then to the point where most people just don't see homosexuality as a problem, even if a lot of people still don't necessarily support legalizing gay marriage. But these shifts are just immense. And as I said, because of this generational replacement and other changes taking place in our society, we do see support for gay marriage going up a percentage point a year. That's going to continue. That there's just no way, looking at the demographics of this country and looking at these generational shifts, to not think this is going to continue. Because, again, for these kids, you know, gay marriage is no big deal. And I don't see how Tony Perkins is going to change this. So I think he's just – they are kidding themselves to think they can somehow stop this one, that they can slow it down. Mm-hmm. You can't slow down history. You can't really do much about demographic change. If they haven't been able to – build a firewall by now, I doubt if they're going to be able to do it. Other data suggests, for example, if you do a little modeling on state-level data, it suggests that by the middle of the next decade, the only places where you could pass a referendum trying to keep a same-sex marriage ban will be in basically deep southern states because the states are just changing quite fast. Now, abortion's a little bit of a different issue. What's changing there is not so much the distribution of views on how easy or hard it should be to get an abortion. That's about the same. People are split somewhat on how easy or hard it should be. People are not split on Roe v. Wade. Still get about two-thirds of the people saying it should not be reversed, the Supreme Court should not vote to reverse it, and so on. But it is true that overall there isn't a great liberalization of attitudes toward abortion. But what is changing is that the rising demographics in our country, again, particularly this millennial generation, it's not salient for them. Mm-hmm. Even those who are perhaps lean more so-called pro-life than pro-choice, they're not going to vote on that basis. They're not going to join the activist groups, and they don't think should be a big part of our politics. So that's a big change as well. I mean, not only the levels of views can change, but also how salient they are to people's politics.
How has President Obama's approach to abortion, especially his advocacy of common ground on abortion, which means essentially keep abortion legal but work to reduce the number of abortions, how is that going to play?
Oh, it's a great idea. I mean, obviously, Bill Clinton had the great line in this, let's make abortion safe, legal, and rare. Mm-hmm. And I think that's essentially what Obama's repeating. Yeah. And I think that's exactly the sort of center of gravity of American public opinion at this point. That's what people want. People don't want big restrictions on abortion. People don't want to overturn Roe v. Wade. And they don't want our politics to be dominated by arguments about this.
I am very excited to hear what you're saying. I'll tell you, my struggle is that you're statistical and demographic data are so convincing. My anecdotal responses to that are not where that data happens to be. I know that E.J. Dionne has wrote about the death of the religious right. I just saw a book coming out by Harvey Cox in which he says that fundamentalism is on the wane. And I pin hopes to that, but what I still encounter every day is not that reality. Is there a gap between the influence of what you're talking about now taking effect, or where am I living?
Yeah, okay, let's chat about that a little bit. It is not the case that the conservative culture warriors have disappeared. It's not the case that even as we go through this transformation, they will disappear. In some ways, they might try to step up their activity because, you know, actually the tides are running against them. They may be feeling a little desperate. They may be feeling like a beleaguered, that they've got to do something. And I think in certain states this will be particularly true, where the demographic trends aren't running quite so strongly or where conservative culture war institutions are particularly strong, there will be an effort to pump up the volume on these issues. But that doesn't change where the country's going. It doesn't change the fundamental transformations that are taking place. They are fighting a losing battle. And what that means very particularly in terms of politics is this, that even though they try to pump up the volume on their issues, even though they try to sort of fan the flames, we live in a political system where politicians only push issues if they feel like in the end it's going to help them more than it's going to hurt them. Yeah. And in state after state, this is no longer going to be the case, that even conservative politicians, even Republican politicians, are fast coming to the realization that these are losing issues for their side. And therefore, no matter how much the conservative culture warriors want these issues to be taken up by their politicians and pushed, these politicians are more and more reluctant to do so because they've got to get elected. They've got to deal with the electorate as it is, not the way they want it to be or the way the culture warriors want it to be. I mean, look at Steve Schmidt, you know, who was McCain's campaign manager, saying after the election, we got to turn down the volume on this gay marriage issue. The country's changing in a way that we just sound completely out of touch. We're in a danger of losing the entire younger generation of voters. This has to stop. We have to move to the center. More and more conservative politicians are going to be saying that, and more conservative politicians are going to be doing that. You know, there'll still be a lot of people out there screaming at them, but they're just going to have less effect.
What a fascinating interview with a very smart man. Rui Teixeira is a senior fellow at both the Century Foundation and American Progress, as well as a fellow of the New Politics Institute. He's the author of several books. His new report, authored for the Center for American Progress, is called The Coming End of the Culture Wars. Rui, thanks so much for being here on State of Belief today.
It was jolly fun.
Well, what do you think? Are the culture wars coming to an end where you live? Do you sense it in the nation as you see it? But what about your thoughts? We want to know them. Go to stateofbelief.com, click on the Contact Us page, and send me an email. I want to hear from you. And don't be shy. I don't think I have to say that. And don't go anywhere right now, because up next is a look at the most famous woman in America you've never heard of. Stay tuned. We'll be right back, and we'll find out all about her. Coming right back. Welcome back to State of Belief, everybody. I'm Welton Gaddy. Before family sitcoms like I Love Lucy or All in the Family, there was The Goldbergs, a show about a fictitious Jewish family that lived in a lively tenement in the Bronx. The program was the brainchild of Gertrude Berg, an early television producer who created, wrote, and starred in the series. Well, she even successfully ushered the show from its beginnings on radio in 1929 to the new medium of television. The Goldbergs ran until 1956. There was also a featured-length film starring Berg as her popular character, the family matriarch, Molly Goldberg. And yet today, the name Gertrude Berg rarely elicits the same recognition as television pioneers like Lucille Ball or Norman Lear. Now, a new documentary hopes to change all of that. The film Yoo-Hoo, Ms. Goldberg tells the story of Gertrude Berg's rise to fame and the many firsts that she accomplished along the way. She was, for example, the first woman to win an Emmy. The film's director, Aviva Kempner, joins me now by phone. Aviva, welcome to State of Belief.
Yoo-hoo! How are you?
What drew you to the story of Gertrude Berg?
Well, my MO of 30 years of filmmaking is making films about underknown Jewish heroes. And this is a woman who wrote, produced, starred in her own TV show, as you said, was the prototype for the domestic sitcom in an apartment building that is the masterful setting for Honeymooners, Lucille Ball, Friends, Seinfeld. I mean, she invented what has turned out to be the most popular format for a sitcom. And also, she wrote this incredible, positive Jewish show with very positive Jewish characters, engaging with actors from the Yiddish theater. It looked, felt, and was Jewish, but beloved in America at the time of the highest domestic anti-Semitism in America and the destruction of European Jewry. And the reason I think the show worked so well is people respected, there was practices of the Jewish religion on both radio and TV, and people respected that because it was a warm family, a family with accents, with family members living there that a lot of Americans identified with, and a family that was facing all the time economic problems and, you know, just problems within the family and the neighbors. And, you know, when you're universal enough, you can also proudly wear your religion on your sleeve.
Well, Aviva, you call Gertrude Berg the most famous woman we've never heard of. When I listen to you talk about her and I read something about the documentary, how did that happen?
Well, I think several reasons why she sort of fell into oblivion. One is the show was never syndicated, and it's hysterical. It's right up there with The Cosby Show, with Lucille Ball, and that's because it was shot in kinescopes and never put in syndication or on DVDs, although now I think they'll be put on DVDs. Second of all, she's very seriously hurt by the blacklist. Her stage husband was blacklisted. They lost the airtime. Lucille Ball replaced their airtime. So the blacklist really made a difference. And then sometimes I have a theory. If you're an early pioneer, you aren't held account, you know, you just never get the credit for what you've done.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the character she created, Molly Goldberg. In your film, I think it's Susan Stamberg from National Public Radio who says that there really wasn't anyone like this character before. She was the new Jewish mother. Now, how was she different? What distinguished
her? Well, first of all, she wasn't nagging, domineering, awful, cruel. This is a woman who was loving and supportive. Of course, she would meddle a little in people's lives, but she really tried to help people solve their problems. She was warm and affectionate. Second of all, she cared about people. Both her family and her very got involved in her neighbors' lives. And that warmth was just felt by Americans, and that's why she was so beloved. The show was second only to Amos and Andy. And actually, I read some of her fan letters, and people would write in even after she had a Passover service saying, you know, we love the show. We were not Jewish, but it brought tears to my eyes because they liked this open practice of religion. And apparently her favorite letter, fan letter, was from a group of nuns who wrote in and say, we love your show, but because of Lent, we couldn't see the show. Is there any way we can get it? And, of course, this is way before DVDs were possible.
Well, just to point out, too, you mentioned that she was a contemporary of Amos and Andy, who were white men, basically.
On radio. I know. I have footage of that in the film. It is unbelievable to me how they did this literal song and dance.
Yeah, and they were basically lampooning African-American culture.
Exactly.
And here, by contrast, Gertrude Berg cast Yiddish actors to play her characters.
Exactly.
Tells you a lot about her right there.
Right.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the role Judaism played in the show. This was obviously a Jewish family. At one point, Gertrude Berg even had a rabbi on her radio program to do the Passover scene. And yet, as you've already alluded to, this was during World War II, the height of anti-Semitism. Father Coughlin was on the airwaves at this time as well, spouting racism. Talk a little bit more about how all of that impacted this program.
Well, at one point in her show, on a radio show, some months after Kristallnacht happened, which was the destruction of German synagogues, she had the family performing Passover Seder, which I'm pretty sure she did every year, and the rock came through the window, and the family continued on to say, you know, we would defy this kind of anti-Semitism. In 1933, after Hitler came to power, she had a Passover Seder on radio, which is a pretty amazing back at that time. She also, on the TV show, had a whole show about getting relatives from the family in Europe and who survived the Holocaust and, you know, what they went through. And so no one else was doing that at that time. She and there's no way in terms of the accent they spoke, the foods they talked about, you know, matzahs, the food she was cooking, it was clearly a very positive, overt Jewish show.
Well, you have already mentioned that the story about the group of Catholic nuns writing, which is both funny but also very insightful and interesting. You interviewed Andrea Roan, a newscaster in Washington, D.C., who says, as a Catholic African-American growing up in Louisiana, that she was able to relate to the show. And
she said one thing first. She says, you know, growing up Catholic in New Orleans, there were Catholics and there were the others. And we didn't even know what people were Jewish. All we knew that family was important, and that's how we related to the show.
Yeah. Well, okay. And is that the key? I mean, what was it that
I think caused it's the
people
key.
To do that?
You know, what's funny how it's working a second time around. I think the show was so successful because it was family. Mm-hmm. And I think it was more successful even now on the screen because so many people are identifying Gertrude Berg as your mother, as your grandmother. As a matter of fact, the Greek witness, Chris Downey, says she talked, she cooked just like my Greek grandmother, except my Greek grandmother had a cross.
My goodness. Well, despite the fact that the show was very popular and very funny, evidently, there was a dark side as well. You've alluded to it. This was the
horrible period of the McCarthy hearings, where if people were union organizers or signed petitions to integrate baseball or were members of the Communist Party, were attacked and prevented from continuing their livelihood because people were scared about keeping them employed. And Philip Loeb, the outstanding stage husband of Gertrude Berg on the Goldbergs, playing Jake to perfection, an actor's actor, was also a great union organizer, and he was blacklisted, and Gertrude Berg did everything she could, including going to Cardinal Spellman, asking him to please make sure that Philip Loeb didn't get kicked off, because she knew he had the inside ear to Hoover.
Now, some people don't remember Cardinal Spellman, and was that why it was so daring, because he had Hoover's ear?
Yeah, right. Now, according to the witness in the film who interviewed Gertrude Berg's late daughter, Harriet, Cardinal Spellman said, I'll help you if you convert. But you have to understand there's another thing happening. The Goldbergs, the warm, fuzzy show about a struggling Jewish family, worked so well on radio, but at the same time, this horrible racist and anti-Semitic priest, Father Charles Claughlin, out of Detroit, where I grew up, was ranting to millions of viewers, you know, or million to listeners. I guess you couldn't see him. And so Norman Lear, the famous producer, says, you know, this was a show that was very important, the Goldbergs, to me, after hearing the rantings of Charles Claughlin.
When you listen to the radio, or probably more particularly watch television today, what parts of the legacy of Gertrude Berg jump out at you?
I think the writing. She wrote over 12,000 scripts. The writing is clever, is warm, is funny, and is caring. And I just defy anyone to live up to that today.
I know. I told our producer a moment ago, I'm going to ask you a question I'm not supposed to ask, because I know that
Jewish.
That the artists that I know don't want someone to ask, did you have a message here? But did you have a message here?
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, I'm clear. When you do films on heroes and heroines, I think the message is, if you have a dream, if you have a talent, go for it. Hmm. And it'll work. I think this is the most inspiring film for women, for anyone in the entertainment business, that you can defy what's happening politically and sociologically. You can defy, you know, the sexism in the industry, and the best emerges all around. She was truly the Oprah of her day, you know, and I'm just feel honored to be able to be the one to channel her and teach her to modern-day audiences.
Aviva, what did make
I don't think there's anything wrong about asking about a message.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
Some of us have more hidden agenda than others. But.
Yeah, it may be the ones with the biggest hidden agenda don't want that question.
Yeah.
What did doing this documentary do to you?
Well, it started me waking up at 6 in the morning. She used to write from 6 to 9, so I'm much more productive early in the morning. Hmm. And, you know, in love with the subjects, you just keep on going.
My guest is Aviva Kempner, the director of the new film, You Who, Ms. Goldberg. And Aviva, tell us briefly the meaning of the title.
What they used to do was call out of the air shaft, Yoo-hoo, Yoo-hoo. So that's why I decided to make this movie and call it You Who, Mrs. Goldberg.
And for more information on the film, visit the website, mollygoldbergfilm.org. Aviva Kempner, this has been delightful. Thanks for being on State of Belief.
Okay, and mollygoldbergfilm.org. You can find out where it is in your city.
I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. And up next, we're going to open the mailbag and share some thoughts from our listeners. You might just hear your words spoken if you've written yet or if you've called. Stay tuned. You're going to like to hear what your fellow listeners have to say. Hello again, everybody. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. And each week here on the show, I ask you to write to me, and I really do mean it. I want you to share your thoughts about the show or simply tell me what's on your mind. I love it when you do that. A listener named James from Pennsylvania wrote in to say, "It is so refreshing to hear a holistic, open-minded, intelligent approach to Christianity. I received a mailer today, which I found offensive for many reasons. I call it Gold for Jesus." James even scanned that mailer and sent me a picture. It's a small advertisement for a place that buys unwanted gold and silver. And then there's a big headline that says, "Want cash?" Now, when you turn the mailer over, in equally large letters are the words, "Jesus saves." The adage, "Be 100% sure you're going to heaven," is followed by several quotes from the book of Romans. Oh, you know what? I'm confused. I'm not quite sure what to make of this one. Will selling your unwanted gold and silver get you to heaven? I didn't know that, and I've been saying something else all these years. What does the book of Romans have to do with wanting extra cash? Either way, James, I'm sorry you got it. I'm sorry there are people sending out stuff like that. You can be assured that's not my understanding of Christianity, and it has nothing to do with the message of Jesus, but thanks for sharing it. A listener named Larry called in from New Mexico, used our new phone line and called in and shared his thoughts about a recent commentary I did on the death of Walter Cronkite. Here's what Larry had to say.
I really appreciated Reverend Getty's comments, postscript, eulogy, as it were, on Walter Cronkite. I was on the other side of the television screen when Walter Cronkite passed on the word about Kennedy, and I was a fan of his for many, 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 many years. And yeah, he was a real quality and a class act, but he was also supported by an awful lot of quality journalists, which just seem to be today there in very short supply. So I really appreciated his comments, and I always wondered why Mr. Cronkite didn't comment in the last 10 years on the sorry state of our political landscape, but I understand a little bit more now that he was just a quality act, and I thank Reverend Getty for mentioning, you know, his deep trust and friendship with Walt Cronkite. That helps me to understand, and do appreciate it. Thank you.
Larry, we were happy to help. And before we go, a very special thank you to Janice, who called in to say that State of Belief airs at 4:30 in the morning where she lives, but she still tries to stay up late enough or get up early enough so she can catch our program. Janice, we respect such devotion. We appreciate your support. We're going to try to do our part to earn that kind of devotion on your part. And we're grateful for the support of all of our listeners. Please keep the comments coming. Go to stateofbelief.com, click on the Contact Us page, and write to us. Or you can call us also, 202-238-3291. That's 202-238-3291. We're waiting for you to ring the phone. And don't forget, State of Belief is brought to you by the Interfaith Alliance. We need your help protecting faith and freedom in America. So please consider becoming a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org. And make sure to tune in next week. There's stories developing even as we speak, and we'll be talking about them, the stories that impact the intersection of religion, politics, and culture. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.